back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sunny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and the Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm great.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, President Trump. Now President Trump. On Tuesday, here we are, is engaging in outreach to foreign lands. No, not China, though he is bending over backwards to make sure that their information pilfering PSYOP TikTok stays active. No, not Russia, though God knows he's figuring out some way to sell Ukraine out to build another Trump resort in, I don't know, Minsk or some other Eastern European city. I speak, of course, of Hollywood, that far outpost of Hollywood, to which Donald Trump has appointed a trio of quote unquote ambassadors to perform outreach on behalf of him. I guess. I don't know. The three names are well-known Republicans in Hollywood. Oscar winner John Voight, last seen asking what a character thought of his erection in Megalopolis. Oscar winner Mel Gibson, who has a new movie hitting big screens on Friday in the form of Flight Risk, and absolutely no history of controversial statements or deeds otherwise. And Sylvester Stallone, three-time Oscar nominee, whose show Tulsa King is a bona fide hit on Paramount Plus as part of the Taylor Sheridan expanded universe. Now, what precisely...
Sylvester Stallone, also we should note, Ronald Reagan foreign policy advisor.
Hey, there's also, he has many ties to many different Republican administrations. Noted adversary of another Republican, Sylvester Stallone. We can discuss that maybe. What precisely these three are supposed to do is unclear, even to the ambassadors themselves. When asked about the honor, Mel Gibson said that no one from the White House had reached out to him before the announcement, and he joked that he hoped it would come with housing, since his home burned down while he was doing Joe Rogan's show. That was a very sad story, and hopefully he gets an ambassadorial residence. Gibson said, quote, "I got the tweet at the same time as all of you and was just as surprised. Nevertheless, I heed the call. My duty as a citizen is to give any help and insight I can," end quote. Which, of course, just raises the question, what help and what insight? Again, what precisely are they supposed to be doing here? Are they raising money? Are they getting MAGA-friendly movies made? Or are they just going to say, hey, we're not going to be in the closet anymore. We're here. We're conservative. We're out and proud. That's what we're doing. Look, as a as a conservative-ish sort of person, I don't know what I am now. Who knows? I'll admit to having felt my share of amusement and annoyance at the single-party state of Hollywood for so many years. There are conservatives and there are Republicans in Hollywood, and they have stayed very, very hidden for the most part, outside of names you know like John Voight, Mel Gibson, Sylvester Stallone. That's about it. Because they are very much at risk of losing jobs, at being blacklisted out of things. The blacklist, very, very real, very slippery, very informal. And the number of folks who use it as a crutch to explain their own lack of success is not zero. There's a lot of weird overlap there. All of which to say is that there's a certain, look, there's definitely a blue ceiling. These guys are out there saying, no more blue ceiling. We're here, we're Republicans, we're back in Hollywood. I just don't understand, Peter, what is this? What is this whole thing? What is going on here?
That's a great question. And as someone who writes and talks about politics for a living and lives in Washington, D.C., and is not very far from the like inaugural ball type events happening as we are taping this, I also would like to know that. I have no idea. And this is the thing about the incoming Trump administration, is that no one, including the people who are the closest to him, seem to know what he is actually going to do. There are on anything. There are scattered reports going through X or Twitter or whatever we're supposed to call it tonight about the possibly hundreds of executive actions that he's going to sign on day one. I guess by the time listeners are hearing this, we will have seen some of them. Like, it will be day one or day two when listeners are listening to this. But as of Sunday night, we don't know. And reporters who are quite well sourced, even with Republicans, are like, yeah, I guess they're going to do some stuff. And it's going to be a bunch of stuff, but we don't know exactly what that is. And that is par for the course for Donald Trump and exactly what you're seeing here. But if I want to try and like tie this back to something that that we actually know about and can actually analyze and can make sense of. To me, what I am seeing here is that what Trump is doing is that Trump is trying to semi-formalize in that Trumpy way of saying it without like there being any kind of paper or real responsibilities or anything, but semi-formalize a relationship between him and the people who like him or might like him in Hollywood. We have seen this over and over with Donald Trump, where like he's just like, yeah, that's my guy. And then a reporter calls that guy and is like, and the guy's like, well, I haven't heard anything from Trump, but yeah, it's, you know, it's, like I voted for him, I guess, right? Or I'm going to vote for him, or I support him, or something like that. And this is a way in which Trump operates. But then also to go back to the previous Republican president, George W. Bush, there were, throughout the Bush administration, stories about these secret, except not that secret, clubs of Bush-supporting Republicans, many of whom were people who considered themselves liberal, who voted for Democrats before 9/11, and who at least the story they told was that 9/11 pushed me over and made me a Republican, made me a conservative of some sort. The one who I remember most who was sort of involved in this, who was always named, was Jerry Zucker, who directed the Naked Gun airplane films, all of those parodies. But then there was like a sort of a group of these folks who were sometimes named, and sometimes you would just sort of get like, oh, there's a bunch of people who you haven't heard of, right? So this is a thing that has been happening in Hollywood, is that there have been these kind of unofficial, secret but not that secret, groups of right of center personalities who, in many of whom, like, thought they were liberals first. David Mamet was maybe not exactly part of these groups, but like followed this trajectory, right? And this seems to me like it's not that in that Mel Gibson is not somebody who just became a Republican. Sylvester Stallone is not someone who just became a Republican, but it is that there's always been this slight undercurrent of right of center politics in Hollywood, even at the something close to the top levels, right? Clint Eastwood was on stage at the RNC. What year was that? 2012, right? 2012, talking to the empty chair in one of the strangest performances I've ever seen from an actor, a movie director, or at a political convention. And this just sort of like Washington, D.C. and presidential politics, Republican politics in particular, never quite knows what to do with Hollywood except to point and say, hey, there's a couple of us out there, right? You know those names. And look, those are all names that are actual real stars who have real records of success. Yes, they're older, but it's not Scott Baio, and it's not, you know, some of these randos who like have been trying to fill that role for the past decade. And this is just more of that.
Yeah. I don't think these names are new or different or surprising to anybody. What is kind of interesting is the semi-official way that Trump has been like, these are my guys, because that is a very different thing from if you want to Google Friends of Abe. That is kind of what Peter is talking about and hinting
that's
at.
Right.
And that's a name. You know, what's that?
I forgot that moniker.
Yeah, that's, you know, and that organization had its ups and downs and was kind of into it and not into it, blah, blah, blah. But like it was always very under the radar, as Peter says. And this is a very different sort of thing. This is a very this is Trump saying these are our conservatives in Hollywood, and also there are more of you and you should probably come out. And it's interesting, Alyssa, because it is kind of a whole, it's a normalization thing, right? Like, it's like, this is him saying, come out of the shadows. We won the popular vote. We are the majority now. This is our world.
Yeah. And I was sort of jokingly thinking up what sort of the alternate acronyms for this would be before I got on the show. But the idea of a sort of, you know, Department of Hollywood Efficiency is actually not a terrible idea at this particular moment. Like, yes, the normalization factor that you're talking about is real, but this is also a sort of interesting moment of reckoning for the entertainment industry. It's been 5 years, almost 5 years, since the COVID pandemic really hit America, shutting down theaters and helping sort of accelerate the decline of a movie-going habit that is not entirely recovered. Production has been moving out of LA for a while, you know, spurred in part by tax incentives that are never really going to pay out for states like Georgia. And also just sort of the initiative of sort of super showrunners like Taylor Sheridan. And now, you know, the wildfires in LA, I think, have raised really serious questions about sort of where movie and TV production are going to be taking place in the future.
Alyssa, you're positioning this thing, though, as like it's a serious idea. You're saying like there are lots of things Hollywood needs to consider. Sure. I don't know what that has to do with what has been announced here.
I don't think like Sylvester Stallone and Mel Gibson and who was the third person? I just like I can't even remember this whole thing.
John Voight.
How dare you? I'm sorry.
Oscar winner John Voight, star of Heat, amongst
others. It's been a long month, guys. It's been like what a year every single week since has been. So I'm not saying that this is remotely like a serious initiative. That said, I do think the industry is going to have to rethink a lot of things, and it is sort of interesting that Trump has tried to sort of open up this channel, not sort of as a supplicant, but as a like, hey, I have stuff, you know, I've got people. And I do think one thing that's really interesting is like Trump appears very, shall we say, susceptible to people who are willing to demonstrate that they like him, right? I mean, he has wanted to be the establishment for his entire, you know, life and career. And so I would be curious to see if more people who are contemplating these questions in a serious way do actually sort of come to DC, participate in the like just the acknowledgement that like, OK, the Trump phenomenon is real. Like, how are we going to do business with this administration? And I think the intensity of the pressures on the industry may make it more likely that people, you know, not just, you know, donate to inaugural, you know, funds or show up at inauguration, but are willing to sort of engage in a way that they might not have been before. And the truth is, you know, I mean, one of the things the Department of Government Efficiency is, or, you know, department, I say that in scare quotes, has been talking about is sort of moving agencies out of Washington around the country.
It's not a department. It's not a department. It's no one even knows what the structure of this thing is.
The thing of government efficiency, the like ectoplasm of government efficiency. And I think there actually is an interesting case for moving Hollywood production or movie and TV production and government agencies around the country for the same reasons, right? Like it's much harder to criticize the swamp or Tinseltown when like they're a part of your local economy. And it could be a very interesting sort of political realignment and sort of political, you know, power-based rebuilding thing for Hollywood to be more like government agencies, which by the way, are already fairly spread around the country. So anyway, I will stop there.
So I think it's not just that Hollywood is going to move right because of Trump, though. Yes, that's I don't want to say that's not part of it, like, but that's only part of it. I think Hollywood is going to move right for several reasons. One is there's already clear demonstrated success in doing so, particularly with Taylor Sheridan. And if I don't know if you guys read Rick Marin's piece in a commentary about a month ago titled "The Anti-Woke King of Hollywood Lets Loose." Subtitle: Taylor Sheridan's shows explain how and why we got Trump again. And it is a quite strong kind of reported cultural essay arguing that Taylor Sheridan is capturing and portraying the new America that it gave us Trump. And I just watched the first couple of episodes of Landman over the weekend. And I got to say, the first episode in particular just like lives up to that premise. Like, it is a it is not a show about Donald Trump. I mean, this was written and filmed a year or two or so before before the election. But it is very much a show about working class Hispanic men, especially in the first episode. But working class Hispanic men who, it's not like they come out and deliver monologues about how they're Trump voters, but they are very much right coded. They are people who clearly, like, you can just tell they would end up as Trump voters. And then there was this, like, there's this tweet going around that like, I've only seen the first couple of episodes of this show. This tweet going around that, like, actually the show is basically just Billy Bob Thornton delivering like anti-woke conservative MAGA monologues to a white liberal lady, which I don't know if that's actually correct, because again, there's seven episodes of the first season that I haven't seen yet. But based on the first three episodes, I totally buy that that's where the show goes. Like, that seems plausible as like a kind of funny summation of this show. And so there is demonstrated success here in the most popular showrunner on television. There's also a desperation in Hollywood right now, in that a lot of stuff hasn't worked, and they feel they have started to recognize. I don't think it's just that they feel. I think they have started to recognize that a lot of the products that Hollywood has put out, especially since the pandemic, but even in the 10 years beforehand, just haven't really connected with a lot of average Americans. You've seen this implicitly in the move to expand the Best Picture nomination for the Oscars, right? The idea that we're going to have that the Oscars are going to have like a best popular film or something like that. But I forget, but award for best film like that has a big box office gross. I forget what they were going to call it, but it was some incredibly dumb category, right? But it was just like, oh crap, we keep making movies that don't connect with normal people. And this is something that, like, Hollywood has been dealing with, not just like even before Trump came on the political scene. And so I think that because they see Trump not only as a political figure, but as a pop culture figure, and that they see that politics and culture in the Trump era are even more so in some ways than the Obama era, are more intimately linked, I think there is going to be a movement, at least in, it's not going to be that like Hollywood is going to start voting Republican en masse. That's not what I'm saying. But I think the types of products they start putting out are going to read as somewhat less overtly liberal, and in some cases, much more explicitly like populist conservative.
Let me make an analogy here, Peter. What you're saying is that basically Hollywood looks at MAGA America like they looked at China about 15 years ago.
We all know how that went.
They made a ton of money until they didn't.
That's basically right, right? Like they're looking at MAGA America and they're saying, we have a large group of people here who we can cater to. And we can provide them entertainments, and we will make a lot of money off of them, probably.
One difference is that it's Americans, more or less, making movies for Americans, if that's the case. Another is that there's no scenario that's really imaginable in which you have essentially a government edict determining how many films can be released, which films can be released, and demanding and demanding significant like additional scenes be added and stuff.
Agreed.
Like that. I'll actually say, go as far as to say that like I guess I can imagine a scenario in which there's some sort of back channeling, and it's not anything formal, but like there are scenes added to movies or like rewrites, things like that, that happen because of discussions between Hollywood executives and political figures, right? Like, that doesn't seem completely insane to me, though it would be totally unofficial. It would just be sort of an we had a dinner and they said, look, this movie, right? Like,
soft power is what you're saying.
But it's not a situation where there's only 35 movies that can be released or whatever the number was that China was limiting to, right? Different thing.
Yeah, you're talking about like the official strictures of the deal between Hollywood and China. That's not what I was saying. I'm talking about markets. I'm specifically talking about markets. That Hollywood looks at what the state of play and says, well, you know what? This Trump guy kind of popular. Maybe we should probably target some of his voters, which is interesting. But also, since you bring it up, I hadn't even actually thought about this. But since you bring it up, this idea that there need to be scenes added or scenes taken out, you don't think that's too far off of what a lot of the discussions on social media like already kind of tend toward? You don't think that's what's happening at Disney every time they take out a subplot that's like, you know what, we actually don't need the gay teen subplot for this new animated movie. We're going to avoid that, which is a thing that has come up repeatedly over the last couple months here.
But I think Alyssa wants to get in here, but I will just say, when Marvel Disney was adding scenes to Avengers or Iron Man featuring Chinese stars, right, was changing the movie, they were doing so to get past Chinese censors, not to appeal to the Chinese audience directly. And if Disney is like looking at social media and deciding, oh, we're going to change this in order to appeal to the tastes of Americans, that is a market decision, not a decision to appeal to government censors.
So Disney's not doing that to get past the tastemakers on social media, Alyssa. They're not worried about angering the large Twitter following
tastemakers on social media.
They're not doing it to get past the Charlie Kirks of the world. They're not doing it to get past the Ben Shapiros of the world. They're just doing it because that's the audience.
Don't make me defend Charlie Kirk. I'm not going to.
No, but I think it's the same thing. It's the same thing.
I mean, it's the same thing. You know, Peter mentioned that the scenes with Chinese actors or where, you know, people were like, Taiwan, which is part of, you know, greater China. You know, we're at it sort of at the behest of Chinese censors. And in fact, there has been intermittent reporting that Chinese audiences found these scenes and these editions unbelievably contrived and sort of odd. What I would be interested to see is, for example, do we start getting more movies with characters who go to church where it's not like a major part of the plot, but, you know, that's like there's a scene that's like at the coffee hour afterwards, or, you know, it's sort of referenced in the schedule.
I mean, we've already seen that to some extent just with these films targeted at evangelicals.
100%. But do we
start
seeing
that quite well?
But do we start seeing that in, you know, something that 20th Century Fox and, you know, Universal and Paramount are putting out? I don't know. Do we start seeing a kind of like move away from the sort of Judd Apatow style, like doofus, you know, man-child protagonist? I think we're already sort of seeing that. But like, do we see more sort of explicit kind of, you know, not marketing to, but like programming around young men in, you know, kind of... I'll be curious to see what this does to romantic comedies, right? I think there are a lot of ways that this could go that, you know, I mean, I think like I'm thinking, for example, about Glenn Powell's character in Twisters this summer, which seems to me like, you know, that movie I don't think did huge box office, but is a potential interesting archetype for a sort of more MAGA-friendly Hollywood, right? Like someone who, you know, has muscles, wears a cowboy hat, like live streams his crazy antics with tornadoes, but then also turns out to be someone who like cares about his community, who like it kind of undercuts a stereotype that liberals have about sort of younger kind of conservative coded men.
Noting that movie did very well domestically and not very well overseas.
So I'll be curious to see.
All right, we're running long here. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Donald Trump has appointed conservative ambassadors to Hollywood? Alyssa?
It's just so hilarious. I feel like describing it as a controversy or non-controversy, like, it's just so funny.
Peter?
What's the, like, contra, nontra, can I get, like, what, WTF-iversy? Like, I don't, I just... I, I don't know how to like render this in my mind.
Well, because it's not a thing. That's why it's a non-troversy, frankly, because it's not a thing. It's just it doesn't it's not a thing that exists. It's just Donald Trump like putting hand. It's Donald Trump putting his hand on three stars in Hollywood and saying, do you feel in charge? That's what this whole thing is, to the extent that he did it without even telling them he was doing it. Come on. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for a bonus episode celebrating the life and work of David Lynch. The director passed away last week. We're going to be discussing what worked, maybe what didn't work for us about his films and all sorts of other stuff. And now on to the main event. September 5, a not quite real-time look at the coverage of the terrorist attack at the Munich Olympics, in which virtually the entire Israeli Olympic team was wiped out by a cell of Black September terrorists. September 5 is, by its very nature, limited in scope. Most of the film takes place in the Munich control room, where the ABC sports team was covering the 1972 Summer Olympics. Jeffrey Mason, who's played here by John Magaro, finds himself in charge of the room when machine gun fire is heard from the Olympic Village. He wakes Marvin Bader, who's played by Ben Chaplin, who is the head of operations, and the two recall ABC Sports President Rune Arledge, who's played by Peter Sarsgaard, to the office to sign off on all of the big decisions that they're going to have to make. Decisions like whether or not to send Peter Jennings, who's played by Benjamin Walker, when archival footage isn't used, into the Olympic Village before it is closed. Decisions like whether or not to broadcast the news live, despite the risk of showing a hostage being executed on TV. Decisions like whether or not to broadcast about this at all, given that the propaganda work the coverage is by nature doing for Black September, or the possibility that it could undercut police action while the hostage situation is taking place. The limited scope of the film will be frustrating for anyone who wanted to get closer to the action. I heard somebody, as they were leaving my theater on Friday, say, oh, I really thought there would be more, you know, of the firefights and that sort of thing. If you want that, you can go see Steven Spielberg's Munich. It's out there. You can rent it and you can watch it on DVD or maybe Blu-ray. I don't know. If that's what you want, I don't know. It's also going to be very frustrating for anybody who wants an in-depth discussion of Black September and whether or not they were justified in their actions, which is what I've seen a lot of on Letterboxd. And you fucking Zoomers out there need to fix your souls, man, because that is not the thing that is really very interesting about this story. I don't know. It's hard to explain why September 5 is compelling without making it sound boring. Because the movie really is just about a bunch of guys and some women muddling through a weird day on the job. That's what this is. This is a weird day on the job movie. They're arguing about who should be handling it. Jennings is like, oh, we got to get the news people out there. The news has to handle this. Sports isn't ready to cover this. They're gonna jump the gun and call these terrorists terrorists. You can't do that on the news. You can't do that. Or trying to figure out how to work around mundane translation problems, right? As it turns out, the only German speaker on hand is Marianne, who's played by Leonie Benesch, who's quickly moving her way up the corporate ranks as the course of this night goes on. This day, the morning, then day, then night. You know, who gets to use the satellite, right? There's a whole thing about the eye in the sky, the satellite, the bird, ABC, CBS, NBC. Who gets the time on the satellite? How long? How can ABC make sure that the world knows this is an ABC production when it goes out on the CBS feed, right? Like, there's all sorts of little interesting, weird quirks that may only be interesting to journalists. Guilty as charged, you know, I can't say for sure, but it is, again, it's kind of universal in the sense that everybody wants to get credit for what they do, right? All of this is relatively small stakes stuff against the enormous stakes of the hostage standoff itself. But, like, what is life except a series of small struggles against the backdrop of enormous horror? All the time, kind of constantly, right? At one point, the camera cuts away to athletes sunning themselves on the outside, and there it cuts again to, you know, the teams playing volleyball indoors while the Israelis are being held at gunpoint by murderous masked monsters, and like it's like life goes on. I don't know. It's troubling and disconcerting and hard to think about. Particularly giving everything else that is going on. The film is spectacularly cast. Magaro, Sarsgaard, Chaplin, Banesh, they're all just like really compelling on screen, even when dealing with, again, what amounts to kind of bureaucratic hassles. It's very tightly paced. At just over 90 minutes. I think it's 95 minutes, something like that. This is not a Quentin Tarantino film, so there is no hope for an outcome that will be any different than the one that occurred 50-some years ago. Maybe one day Eli Roth makes the, you know, Munich exploitation film that we all want, but that is not what we have here. It is the story of what happened, and as such, is occasionally frustrating, is frequently deeply infuriating, and is saddening throughout. Alyssa, before we get to discussing September 5, there is some news about another hostage situation that's kind of unfolding tonight. We're taping this on Sunday. What's happening?
Yeah, I wanted to just take a minute to acknowledge that Romy Gonin, Emily Damari, and Doran Steinbrecher were released. They were kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th. They're the first of 33 hostages who are due to be released in succession under the terms of a ceasefire that the Israeli government and Hamas signed recently and that went into effect over the weekend. And I just wanted to take a minute to say that I'm really glad that Romy, Emily, and Doran are home. Peter and I watched this movie on Saturday night when, you know, the ceasefire had been signed, but we weren't sure who even was going to be released. And until those, you know, that prisoner exchange happens, Israel released about 90 people tonight, sort of just before we're taping this episode. People who have been in custody for 15 months actually make it back to Israel, you don't know that it's going to happen. And, you know, we still don't know who's going to come back, who's going to be alive. But, you know, the tension of waiting to find out who was going to be free it was impossible for me to disentangle that from the movie that I was watching. And I just, you know, I wanted to acknowledge that those three are alive when, you know, the people who were taken hostage in 1972 were not. So
I think, look, this is one of the very difficult things about this movie, because it is very hard to disentangle what is happening in this film from what is happening right now, from what is happening all the time. That's a hard line to draw, because we're here to discuss the movie and whether or not it works as a movie. And I don't know that I can. I pride myself on being able to do that, to be able to say thing on the screen, thing in the world, not the same thing. I had a very hard time with that with this movie.
Yeah. And I want to say, not setting that aside, because it's impossible to set, you know, what's happening in Israel and Gaza aside from this movie, I thought it was really, really outstanding. It is an excellent movie about journalism in two ways. First, it is just a fabulous craft movie, right? It is, you know, without explaining too much about the challenges of producing news in this, you know, still sort of analog era, does a wonderful job of saying, okay, you want to patch Peter Jennings in from the room in the Olympic Village where he's watching all of this unfold, you're going to have to solder some stuff together in the phone that he's calling in from to your, you know, your broadcast board. You want to get your film on air really fast? Like, actually, like, you've got to fake an ID for a guy so he can run in and out of the Olympic Village with film under his, you know, his windbreaker. And then, you know, you've got to develop the film. You see, like, the chemicals running over the film and get it on air. You want to put on a chyron, you have to do it manually. And so it's a wonderful movie about just the sort of physical and procedural nature of putting out the news. But it's also a strong movie about just the moral gray areas in putting out the news, right? I mean, this is a movie about, you know, the things that you can't foresee. For example, okay, you're broadcasting this live. That's incredibly exciting. Oh, wait, you have no idea that, you know, the terrorists holed up in the Olympic Village can be watching what you're broadcasting on TV. And now you have to cut the feed and figure out, oh, God, are we responsible for botching this rescue attempt? It's a movie about making mistakes, right? I mean, they give the go ahead to ABC's broadcaster to say that the hostages have escaped and are alive based on sort of weak sourcing and with some weasel words, and they're wrong. And that, you know, the movie doesn't dwell on the extent to which, you know, that kind of error, especially one that's corrected quickly, can still do real damage. But it is, you know, it is a movie that is, doesn't, you know, does not necessarily lionize journalism in the way that something like The Post or Spotlight does, but rather maintains extraordinarily sort of compassion for the journalists who are making hard decisions and sometimes bad decisions. And I really think this is an excellently acted movie. I mean, I've talked about my fondness for John McGarrah before, really stretching all the way back to his experience as sort of a small-time short seller in The Big Short. You know, who's outstanding in past lives. He's going to be in Maggie Gyllenhaal's Frankenstein movie. It's not clear in what role yet, but I'm like, yes, like, just put it in my veins. Like, John McGarrah, you're outstanding. And it's also, it's really kind of fun to see Peter Sarsgaard playing Rune Arledge after having played my former colleague and good friend Chuck Lane in Shattered Glass, the movie about the sort of Stephen Glass New Republic saga. And it's worth noting for anyone who sort of wasn't hip to this aspect of the movie, Rune Arledge was one of Bob Iger's mentors early in his career. And so it's very interesting to see the sort of someone who really, you know, kind of shaped the guy who would end up shaping Disney. There's this great line in Iger's memoir about Arledge, you know, he was the first person I ever worked for who embraced technological advancements to revolutionize what we did and how we did it. Reverse angle cameras, slow motion replays, airing events live via satellite, that's all Rune. He wanted to try every new gadget and break every stale format. He was looking always for new ways to connect to viewers and grab their attention. And so if you care about sort of the entertainment industry in the last 20 years, this is actually a really, like, on the sly, a very interesting movie about someone who had a big impact on the person who had a big impact on it.
I think it's also, Alyssa, just very briefly here, the look, we talk a lot about politics feeling like a blood sport or politics being essentially like ESPN at this point. Yeah. You know, a lot of horse race coverage, a lot of who's winning, who's down, who's up and who's down. And one of the real central conflicts here is, again, news versus sports. Sports saying we can do this and we can do it because we can cover it better. We can cover it better. We are here. We've got the cameras on it. We can do it. But also without, frankly, and I think, you know, I think it's the portrayal of Peter Jennings here is interesting because he is portrayed as kind of an officious, stuck up news guy who, you know, is like standing in the way of these sports guys having their moment, but he's not wrong entirely. He's wrong about some things. He's wrong about the hesitance, for instance, to portray Black September as terrorists, but he's not wrong about sports not quite understanding the context of everything here and how to like discuss it. Right?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the questions in the film is do you, what matters most, technology and proximity or contextual knowledge? And I think the film does a good job of sort of answering for both sides, though ultimately I think it comes down on the side of proximity and technology rather than context, though it recognizes that if you don't have the contextual knowledge, there's going to be limitations.
And that, I think you're right. I think you're right, Peter. I think that is how the movie sides. I also think that is probably bad just in general. I think it's not ideal for how we cover certainly important things like politics compared to
the way the movie captures this debate primarily it's this divide between news and sports, but in two specific instances. One is, what do we call these people who have taken these hostages? And the sports people literally don't know what to call them. And they're like, eventually they realize, well, these are terrorists and we have to call them terrorists. They like come up with a bunch of other words. They're like, yeah, I guess they're terrorists.
Gorillas.
And they literally get and they're anxious about, like, they don't know.
I just want to say specifically they do this because the German police use the word terrorists, right? This is a line in the movie. They say, well, what did the German police call them? Terrorists? All right, fine. That's what it is.
And then the argument that Peter Sarsgaard makes is, I'm going to paraphrase this, but this is close-ish to a quote, is, we're here. We're going to point the camera at the story and see what happens. And because it's happening 100 yards from us, we're better positioned to tell this story because we got a camera and it's right here. And so in part, this is a story about technology and new technology. And what some of the moral dilemmas that come up, the biggest moral dilemma comes in part from the fact that this technology is new. There's this like very brief thing that you almost can miss about how this is the first Olympic Games where everything is really broadcast live. And all, there's all this brand new live technology that sort of like, and this is set up at the beginning, but like it doesn't dwell on how new this is. And for those of us who were not alive in 1972, which is all of us on this podcast, we're just so used to live broadcasts, right? Like, and they're like, even, yes, like way before the era of you could broadcast live from your phone, like the idea that like, yeah, news networks would just be there broadcasting live, that has been part of our lives for forever, but it wasn't always part of the business of news. And that's one of the things that this movie does in a really subtle way is it shows us when new technology is around, like it takes part in a news event, in a major news event, a fairly shocking and horrible news event in this case. It like that technology ends up playing a role, and the journalists who are operating that technology end up having to figure out in real time how to use it and what role that technology is going to play. And that, like, obviously has a lot of implications for today. And it's, I mean, it reminded me, among other things, of that incredible Tony Shalhoub monologue in the Coen Brothers movie, The Man Who Wasn't There, right, where he's talking about it's not string theory, but it's like, oh, you know, he's like, if you want to find out what's happening in the world, you got to look at it. But the whole thing is, if you look at something, sometimes looking at it changes it. And you can never know what would have happened if you hadn't looked at it. And this is the problem for journalism and for journalists. And it's like the fundamental moral dilemma in this movie is that like they're looking at this thing, pointing the camera at the story and seeing where it goes might change the story. And you see that most clearly dramatized in the moment where the German police are clearly about to stage some sort of operation. And they realize that the terrorists who inside the Israeli living quarters are watching the television, watching the broadcast feed of the German police. And so they can see what is happening in real time. And the journalists who are involved in this are, of course, like horrified at their own, like the potential for their own role in this. And they don't know what their own role is. Like even after this plays out, they're like, well, are we the ones who caused this operation to be canceled and pulled back? They have no idea. Like it's totally unclear to them because they're working in sort of the fog of war here, right, themselves. But it's just such a great movie about the sort of ethical dilemmas of journalism, but also the technology of journalism. And like, if you can step back from the kind of the horror of it, which is hard, and maybe not even the best way to watch the movie. Like, there's this secondary thing that's happening, which is that this movie is this great love letter to old analog technology and just the sort of the process aspect of journalism. And there are so few movies that actually just show you, like, the nuts and bolts of what it takes to to find a story and then to actually make it, like, get it into place. And so many movies about journalism, like, treat it as this, I don't know, it's like a detective story, but it sometimes it is. That's part of it. But a lot of it is just like the physical nuts and bolts of getting a bunch of people to work together to operate a bunch of machines, whether it's computers and cameras or whether it's, you know, soldering phones into the soundboard. Right. And this movie just reminds you what it was like before the digital age and how physical and like interestingly intricate it was. And I just loved as an audio guy, somebody who likes speakers and likes like stuff that's wired together. I loved that aspect of this movie. And it's a pretty rare thing to see on film. And like the filmmakers really just sort of, fetish is the wrong word, but like they really go in for showing you all of the aspects of physical production here in a way that is quite unusual. And this is one of the better journalism movies I think I've ever seen. I mean, and partly because of Peter Sarsgaard, it reminded me actually a lot of Shattered Glass, the movie about Stephen Glass and the fabulism at the New Republic. Because that movie is less obsessed with the physical technology, but it's a process film about how journalism happens and just like the step-by-step nature, right? There's literally a montage in Shattered Glass about the fact-checking process that was brought over from the New Yorker to the New Republic, and like it shows you like all the steps, right? And this movie, similarly, is just like a step-by-step kind of journalism procedural for journalism of an earlier era and for journalism of a new technological era, and reminding us that every time you bring a new technology to cover the news, you will end up with moral and ethical dilemmas that are very hard to solve.
What's also kind of interesting about this movie, Alyssa, is that it's a production of, I don't know if you guys saw all the credits before the movie started, but it's very much a production that was made in concert with the German film industry. Like the Germans were, you know, funded a lot of this. There's a lot of the director himself, whose name escapes me at the moment, I'll look it up in a second, is also German. And part of the point of the film is Munich, the games were supposed to be Germany saying to the world, hey, we're back. You know, things are better now. And then things go very, very wrong very quickly, which is kind of an interest. Like, it's interesting that the German film industry would make a movie like that. There's an interesting kind of, I don't know, self-reflection there that I find hard to imagine in similar contemporary American circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. And I will mostly add to it by noting I'm reading Gary Bass's book about the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunals, which are the sort of much less acknowledged, because they're a much less functional, counterpart to the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunals. But it's a very interesting book about how the Japanese public sort of came to understand themselves and their society in the aftermath of World War II. And I think that, you know, one thing that I think American students and just Americans in general don't learn very much about is sort of what happened in both Germany and Japan after World War II. And that question of, you know, sort of self-reflection, self-reconception, reintegration back into the international order. I mean, to this day, you know, West Germany and Japan remain some of the sort of only successful kind of democracy building efforts that Western powers have undertaken. And so I think that's a sort of underratedly valuable aspect of this movie, that it may acquaint some audiences with sort of a facet of Germany and sort of this question of intergenerational guilt and societal reconception that they haven't done before. There's this sort of early moment where, you know, one of the ABC executives, you know, sort of asks if, you know, ask Marianne, it's like, were your parents alive during the war, as a way of saying that she's sort of suggesting that she sort of bears some guilt for Germany, for, you know, Hitlerite atrocities in German. And she's like, yes, but I'm not them. And he, you know, he sort of recognizes that he's gone too far in kind of ascribing intergenerational guilt to her. It's early in the movie, but very interesting. And very well acted.
Yeah, seems like we need a double feature of this movie and The Brutalist, but a special double feature where you play this movie in the intermission, right? Like this, like, yeah, you watch that, you get to see the photo in the intermission of The Brutalist, but you see this movie in the middle and like, and then come back and see the second half of it.
And then afterwards you watch Munich.
That's a long day.
I'm not really sure this really works in the middle of The Brutalist, but as you precede this, then you play Munich, and then you play Inglourious Basterds at the end. That's all I'm. The director's name is Tim Felbaum. He's a German fellow
And a young guy,
young person. Did you guys have the Q&A after the film at your screening?
We could not say to see it.
No. You didn't miss much. It wasn't that interesting, frankly. But it was interesting to see him, because I was like, oh, you're like what, 28 probably? I don't know. You're young. Damn you.
He's 41. He was born in 82.
Oh, he just looks good. Good for him. Yeah. How about that?
He's Swiss. You know,
all right.
They got the Swiss genes.
I'm younger than him. I still have my chance to make a mark on the world.
Sure. Yeah, all of us. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on September 5? Alyssa?
Thumbs up. It's really good.
Peter?
Good movie, and it's not playing in many theaters, but if it's playing near you, you should seek it out.
Thumbs up, good movie. It is playing near me. It's playing in a handful of theaters. Got nominated for, I believe, a PGA Best Picture award. We'll see how that goes. But it's a solid picture. I hope folks check it out if they can get to it. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I'll come into that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.